W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. They've arrested the man accused of firing inside an Atlanta medical facility waiting room, killing a woman and injuring four others, Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens.
Not only did law enforcement bring this man into custody, they also kept our community safe during an enormously tense afternoon and evening.
Police say 24-year-old Deion Patterson was taken into custody hours later with the help of multiple departments. At the White House,
75 years of a desegregated military, 75 years of women full integration, 50 years of an all-volunteer force. And that's hard to believe because I remember most of that. Worrisome. Worrisome.
President Biden hosting the nation's military leaders for the annual Combatant Commanders Dinner. Florida has executed 56-year-old Daryl Barwick for a 1986 stabbing death of a woman months after he was released from prison for rape. This is ABC News. Eli Lilly says its experimental Alzheimer's drug appears to slow progression of the disease in a large clinical trial, but there are safety concerns, including three deaths out of 1,700 patients. Writers taking to picket lines outside studios in New York and Hollywood. It's the second day of a strike. More from ABC's Melissa Aiden in L.A.
Everyone wants to get some sort of agreement on the table, renew those contracts so then we can move forward with all sorts of productions. But until then, that's where the screenwriters say that they're holding firm and plan to continue striking day after day, meaning your favorite late night shows, they're airing reruns. This goes into the weekend. We're looking at Saturday Night Live not being live.
The issue is pay for streaming services. He's on the road again, this time to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Willie Nelson leading the 2023 induction class, along with Sheryl Crow, Kate Bush, Chaka Khan, Rage Against the Machine, Missy Elliott, The Spinners, and George Michael. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM, WGBW programming, is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. University Wisconsin Health and Unity Point Health Meritor are ending their mask requirements. Unity Point says the public health environment surrounding the coronavirus is getting better. Republican lawmakers are taking 545 of Governor Evers' state budget proposals off the table. The Budget Writing Joint Finance Committee took the first votes on the spending plan yesterday. Senator Dewey Strobel says non-fiscal items like free school lunch and Brewer Stadium maintenance don't belong in the spending plan.
When you go from a $7 billion surplus to a $4 billion deficit in 2 years, that's just crazy.
The budget debate is expected to play out for several more weeks. In sports, the Rockies beat the Brewers last night 3-2. Eric Lauer starts tonight for Milwaukee. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the grave digger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where is always a standard room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come pick it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football fans. Fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
If you are 45 and older, don't let stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
But then...
for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, earlier today, Pennsylvania Department of Education Executive Deputy Secretary Angela Fitterer, she visited a nearby elementary school to thank the educators for their hard work and dedication ahead of the National Teacher Appreciation Week. And she had to say, she said, educators play a critical role in helping to inspire and nurture our children who will be important leaders in the future of the Commonwealth. And in my mind went to this place of going, you know, it's a far cry than what we hear in other states. Where, you know, teachers are not only not being thanked or appreciated or honored, but are actually, they're actually the target. So it's good to see that the Shapiro administration here in Pennsylvania valuing educators. But again, this attack on education, this attack on teachers, this is real and it's growing even in my backyard. And here to share some thoughts on just how dangerous and how bad this can be, I've asked Randy Weingarten to come talk with us. Randy is the president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
It's my pleasure.
So I got to start with the first thing. New York Times Magazine has you as the, how does the title go? The most dangerous person in the world. That's the title of their article.
Well, the magazine, I mean, frankly, what the magazine does is it narrates what's happening in America now through the eyes of the right wing. And they have every right to do that. They just should have said that that's what they were doing. And what has happened is the guy who said that, Mike Pompeo, you know, did it for political reasons, called what teachers teach filth, and, you know, he couldn't get any traction on it. Just like, you know, what we saw in Chicago, where you had Brandon Johnson, who when he started in the polls was at about 2%, running against a privatizer and someone who was paid for, who got lots of political contributions from the Betsy DeVos, you know, side of the Republican Party. And, you know, Brandon Johnson, who believes in public education and believes that all kids should have the resources to thrive, he won in Chicago. So, you know, what we're seeing is that people really want their kids to be okay. Yeah. And they want their kids to get a decent education. And frankly, they don't want these culture wars, and they don't want this divide. But yet what you're seeing is that the dividers and the privatizers, they're trying to recreate each and every day more anger. So they go and, you know, smear and scapegoat, which is what they did in the New York Times Magazine and what they did last week in hauling me in for 3 hours of testimony and subjecting me to long statements without being able to answer a question.
Yeah, there was no testimony, though, there. That was just a public lashing. But here's the thing. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you're now the face of or being made the face of the shutdowns that happened. And you're being targeted as the person responsible for all of the stuff that people are angry about. And look, there's an awful lot of Monday morning quarterbacking going on here, because I do remember what 2020 was like. I do remember we didn't know what things how things were going to play out. So I do find it interesting that these people now are trying to rewrite what went on in 2020.
Right.
When Trump was president, guys were actually had a plan to keep schools open. You guys actually had a way forward. It's just nobody wanted to listen.
Exactly right. I mean, I shouldn't say that. There were
nobody in the administration wanted to listen.
Yeah. I mean, we were the first ones. This is what the irony is here. And this is why they don't have any proof of what they're saying. So they're just smearing and scapegoating. But the truth is, we did have a plan from April 2020. No one really knew what was going on. Everybody was fearful. If we knew then what we know now, we would have done a lot more like what they did in Europe, which was schools would have been the priority, not the economy. And there would have been basic mitigations in schools, including good ventilation and ultimately testing and then vaccines, so that people would have been safe. Because after that first wave, the variants were not as deadly and lethal, even though over 1 million people died in America. And frankly, 245,000 kids were orphaned. But this is what is more amazing to me than their revisiting of history and ignoring the fact that we had a plan, but our plan was open safely. What is happening right now is the same group of people, when we should be focusing on how we help kids right now. If you believe that there were all these problems that emanated from the pandemic, then the responsibility should be how we help kids now. And these same exact people are trying to cut budgets and try to cut money for helping kids with loneliness and trying to cut money for helping kids with learning loss and trying to cut funding for helping make sure that schools are, you know, have the resources that they need to help kids thrive. So the hypocrisy here is really unbelievable. But what I care about is that they're trying to deepen a divide in America rather than solve the problem we have to solve for, which is how we make sure our kids have a welcoming and safe environment and help them regain confidence and overcome loneliness and leap ahead academically. That's what teachers are trying to do, even in the midst of this culture war. That's why we try to give out books, 1.5 million already, when they are banning books. That's why we try to teach honest history when they are trying to hector us. That's why we are focused on things like community schools and experiential learning, because even with this demagoguing, we want to help our kids thrive. Yes. We are not afraid of knowledge. Knowledge is empowering. I don't know why they are afraid of knowledge or actually making sure all kids thrive.
See, I think you've got it all wrong here. I think you think that they actually care about kids and they care about education. They care about money. The thing that's always interesting to me is it's Education Incorporated cares about money, and destroying the public schools, my local public school, destroying that and defunding it, that seems to be the plan. And you talk to some of these groups that are now propping up, these Moms for Liberties groups that are trying to take over school boards. It's all about restraining. It's all about banning. It's all about, anything but educating my kids.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that they try to do. They just try to fear and smear. And our members educators around the country, and frankly, most parents, we are together trying to help kids learn. I love that this group called Parents Together, it's an online parent group that represents about 3 million parents. They were so offended by what happened last week. They put out an email to all of their members about what a sham hearing it is. And frankly, they represent a whole lot more people than, you know, this group that Betsy DeVos has funded.
Yeah, I do want to get your thoughts on that hearing last week with the House Oversight Committee, the subcommittee hearing on school closures. And I watched it, and I'm going, you know, this isn't a hearing. This is an attempt to publicly shame. This is an attempt to rewrite history. There was no give and take. I mean, how do you sit there? I guess this is my question, because I think I would struggle with it. How do you sit there and have people say horrible things about you, call you all kinds of names, and then are told you can't respond? I don't know how you do that.
Look, I think that this is part of the reason why I would hope that anyone who watched that hearing saw that, you know, how not, you know, how inappropriate it was. I believe in government and democracy, Rick. And so even though I knew it was going to be unfair, I thought, unlike all those Trump appointees who refused to testify before Congress, I felt an obligation as an American, as someone who was engaged in this, to testify. And what was interesting to me is that they wanted to make it a showboat, and they didn't want to hear me. They didn't want to hear all the different times we tried to open schools safely, and the Trump administration refused to act and refused to do that. They thought the teachers were dispensable, and they, you know, didn't care. And you could hear that in the questions that some of the Republicans asked. What I thought was really fascinating was at the end of the hearing, the chair of the committee says to me, "I don't disagree with the two changes that the CDC made upon your request. I don't disagree. The issue is just process," to which I then said to myself, so Americans can't talk, Americans who are involved in schools shouldn't be able to talk to the CDC for half an hour to actually make sure we reopen schools safely? And because we did, and because they put out what they put out, and Biden put out what he put out, we went from 46% of the schools open in January 2021 to 97% of them open in May 2021. I mean, so even though you could see they didn't want to hear me because they didn't want to hear the truth.
Yeah. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT.org, the website. And I want to clarify that for a second, because a lot of the stuff that you got done, you had proposed to the Trump administration earlier.
Yes.
It's not you who did this. It was the people in power. You were advocating to make sure that that kids had an opportunity to go back to school. It was the Trump administration that stopped
this. It's even worse than that, Rick, because the Trump administration refused to talk to us. And you had to see the chairman's face when I said, well, the only commission I actually sat on was the Cuomo commission. I sat on that, his reopening commission. We actually put a paper out in, I think it was June or July. Virtually every school in New York State was reopened. And he said, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, you didn't ask me about that. I'll give you those documents. So the people like Governor Cuomo, who tried to figure out both how to reopen schools and keep them safe, and, you know, they just didn't want to hear it. Yeah. But DeVos and Trump refused to talk to teachers or to our union or to anyone to actually problem solve what they said they wanted to do. And even now there's a new COVID study that says if you had done that, like Europe did, you would have had more schools open because we would have been able to meet the fear with facts, which is what we needed to do.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
And this we is the wanted question. Schools open for kids. We knew it was important, but we needed to keep it safe for the people who teach them and for the kids themselves, since 245,000 children were orphaned by COVID.
But it's this you said, you know, the facts. And you know, during the Trump years, we came up with these alternative facts stuff. Now, you listen to, depending on which hat people are wearing, they've got their own set of reality and their own set of facts. You know, if I'm hearing what you're saying, had we gone in the direction that you wanted to do, things would have been better. We just had a Trump administration
exactly.
hell-bent on not. I want to make sure I get that clear, because all I'm hearing, Randy, is it was you. You personally closed the schools. You personally made our kids dumb. You personally did all this. It was you, the most dangerous woman in the world, not just here,
it's just,
but
you
the
know,
world.
You know, Rick, if I had one millionth of the power that they attribute to me, I would hope that I would use it a whole lot better than they do.
So let me ask you this, because, you know, you mentioned it a bit ago, anti-intellectualism. It seems to be a badge of courage today.
Anti-knowledge. I would not say intellectualism.
Okay, anti-knowledge. Well, however you want to frame this. My grandfather used to joke, if he doesn't know it, it isn't worth knowing. Now, he was being facetious in this. I believe there are people who have now taken that as their core ethos. If they don't actually know it, then it doesn't exist and it doesn't matter, and it's got to be made up in a lie. How did we get here?
Well, you know, fear is a great motivator. And I think what has happened is, you know, Trump and his ilk are very good at creating fear in a situation where we've had a huge, you know, globalization, technology. We saw jobs disappear from the middle of the country, from the Northeast. We've seen, you know, unions get decimated. I mean, it's not as if the last 20 or 30 or 40 years were good for the middle class. And so you see a lot of anxiety. And then on top of that, you have COVID, which created a lot of anxiety. Yeah. And so you either try to solve those problems or you exacerbate those problems. And what is happening right now is that MAGA, you know, the MAGA world, leans on the leadership, not the workers, not the people, but the leadership tries to stoke fear. That's what Trump did.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And we, as teachers, we try to instill hope and aspiration. And knowledge, the power of knowledge is the power of aspiration.
So
the power of knowledge is the power of hope. It's a power of being able to navigate the world. It's not the only thing one needs. You know, one needs to be able to eat, to have a home or roof over your head. But knowledge is agency. And what's really one of the things that are so disturbing about this culture war, just like what happened with Darwinism and the Scopes trial, is that it's anti-knowledge. It is trying to shield children from knowledge. And I put my bet with kids that when they know what the real deal is in the world, it's going to be a better world. It's going to be a kinder world. It's going to be a more diverse world. It's going to be a world where we're solving problems. And there's a fear of that. And you see that in this banning of books and this not wanting kids to know each other's history. It's an attempt to shield from the future. And you can't shield from the future. We need to seize the future.
I'm with you. I know, because I got to be honest. You know, I learned about book bannings and, you know, how they used to burn records and book burnings and all this stuff. And you go, what were these crazy people thinking in the past? Sadly, we're in this moment. So last question I've got for you, you know, given everything we've talked about, how do we move this forward? I mean, the right wing message machine is powerful. The echo chamber is incredibly influential. How do we get reality out in this world?
Because poll after poll, look, not even polls. I was, for the last 2 years, I think I've been to 147 schools in the last 2 years. The dominant feeling in this country when it comes to education and when it comes to labor is we want our kids to learn and thrive, and we want to have agency and power at work, and workers have to have a share of the economic pie. And so that's where voting becomes important. That's where engagement becomes important, because the real problem here is the bullying is to try to silence me, try to silence others. And apathy and bullying are the tools of the autocrat. So the more they bully, the more they try to smear and scapegoat, the louder I'm going to be, the more engaged I'm going to be in the fight to defend public education, in the fight to strengthen public education, in the fight to strengthen our country. A great nation is not afraid of knowledge. A great nation is not afraid of books. A great nation cares about its kids. So they want to bully me? That is just making me more determined and my members more determined to help our kids and our country thrive.
Well, good on you, Randy. I appreciate the work that you do. I appreciate the work that teachers do. And look, the teachers that taught my kids during the pandemic, I give them nothing but credit for the work that they did. I look forward to talking to you again, and keep up the fight.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Randy Weingarten, president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Now, there's a bumper sticker. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. That's all.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
As I said, there's a bumper sticker. A great nation is not afraid of knowledge. I wish there was a political party that actually believed that. And, you know, you look again, what they're doing. it's all about holding us hostage. Holding education hostage. And I look at the Donald Trump campaign video that was just released where he outlines his grand scheme, the grand plan to go after colleges and universities, their endowments. If they have the audacity, if they're one of those people practicing affirmative action, we're going to go and steal their money. good luck on that. Let's see how that works. Let's see how it works itself out. But again, it's this kind of every grievance that you hear on right-wing radio, that you hear on the F channel, is now turning into policy. It really is, and it's quite frightening when you stop and think about the world that they want to recreate. Because all you got to do is look back to where we came from. We're going to make America great again. I argue we are a great country. Or we used to be, because we used to believe in those principles of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, that you have the right to do whatever it is you want to do as long as your right doesn't infringe on mine. And that's always been my belief. I may not agree with what you do. I may not like what you do. I may not you want to be around you when you do what you do. But as long as it doesn't infringe on my right to lead my life, you do it. You pursue your happiness. And if we were that country, when I grew up as a kid, that worried about themselves and worried about their families more than what people that they don't even know are doing, I think we'd be much better off. And maybe if we invested in education instead of threatening to steal endowments. Now, I'd be in favor of going, we're going to make those endowments pay for people's education. I could go with you on that. But just snatching it away? No, not there. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the birthday of folk musician Pete Seeger. Seeger and his music would become staples of the U.S. labor movement. He was born into a musical family. His father was a scholar of musicology, and his mother was a concert violinist. During the 1940s, Pete Seeger joined with folk music legend Woody Guthrie to form the Almanac Singers. The band traveled the country supporting the Congress of Industrial Organizations. At picket lines, union meetings, and workers' rallies, Pete Seeger was there providing the music for the movement. In the 1950s, Seeger became the target of the anti-communist hysteria that swept the nation. He was blacklisted, shows were canceled, he lost a recording contract. Yet despite this repression, Seeger kept singing the songs of working people and standing up for justice. During the 1960s, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the environmental movement all marched to Pete Seeger tunes. When Seeger died at the age of 94, labor leader Jen Fuentes reflected on the impact of his music in an article in USA Today. She said, "These songs are what allowed workers to sustain themselves during times of adversity. He's a legend in the labor movement for his folk music that has spoken to the labor struggles throughout the year."
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Which side are you on?
When public officials get themselves mired in the muck of corruption, they can always count on Senator Ted Cruz to issue a moral judgment. If the offender is a Democrat, he pronounces the corruption inexcusably grotesque. If it's a Republican, he wails that the offender is the victim. For example, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was recently caught, yet again, butt deep in judicial immorality, taking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of freebies from a Texas real estate baron who has both a partisan and corporate interest in Thomas's court rulings. So, Cruz to the rescue. "No judicial impropriety here," he squawks, "for this is nothing but a diabolical plot by Democrats to smear poor Clarence." But Thomas is busy smearing himself, so Dems can just take the advice of Woodrow Wilson. Never attempt to murder a man who's committing suicide. From the start of his court tenure, Thomas has been a shameless seeker of personal gain, tucking untold sums from untold sources in the inner pockets of his judicial robes. He learned to hide his corruption in 2004 when he actually reported taking pricey gifts from a special interest, which got him widely condemned. So he reformed. No, he didn't quit taking gimmies, he just quit disclosing them. Thomas is a supreme grifter, but sadly he's not alone. Many recent justices have fallen from the pedestal of judicial integrity, cozying up to the moneyed interests. Gifts aside, we now have a hyper-partisan right-wing Republican majority taking their judicial opinions from those same interests, turning America's unelected third branch of government into an autocratic, plutocratic political agency. Then they wonder why their public approval rating and legitimacy are in the ditch. This is Jim Hightower saying, since they won't reform themselves, we must do it for them. To help, go to fixthecourt.com. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So on Monday, as we talked about, the Supreme Court agreed to take up this Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo case that, you know, I didn't know anything about until you look into it. And the case experts have told me, people who know this stuff, who do this for a living, tell me this could mean the end of something called the Chevron deference, something that's been evidently decided years ago, decades of decided law. Remember, these are the people who believed decided law is decided law. They're not going to make up stuff as they go along. They have deference to the law. there's something there. I'm here to talk about what it is, what it means, and how bad it could be for we, the working people. I've asked my good friend Eel Millhiser to come talk with us. Ian is the senior correspondent over at Vox, vox.com, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do there. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
So, what the hell is this? Again, you start talking Chevron deference and something else. It sounds like a lot. What's this mean? What is this going to do?
So the short version here, like most of the important cases that the Supreme Court decides don't actually deal with like what the law is or what the rules are that we have to comply with. Most of the most important questions deal with who gets to decide the important questions. And a lot of important questions have historically been decided in the first instance by Congress. Like Congress makes all the federal laws. But then Congress will sometimes pass a law and say, like, you know, we want to delegate to the Centers for Disease Control the power to decide what to do in the case that there's a pandemic. Or we want to delegate to the Department of Labor the task of determining, you know, who should be eligible for overtime pay. You know, we want to delegate to the EPA the task of figuring out, this was an actual case, by the way, how much nitrogen emissions should be released by wastewater treatment plants. Because, you know, Congress has more important things to do than to micromanage those small questions.
And they may not have the intelligence or the ability to do this. You want smart people. You want smart people who dedicate their lives to figuring this stuff out, right?
Exactly. Like, I have no idea how much nitrogen should be emitted by a wastewater treatment plant. I would like, you know,
I didn't even know nitrogen was emitted.
Yeah. Like, I would like someone who actually knows what they're talking about to make that determination. And so Congress delegates powers to expert agencies to make these decisions. Chevron deference basically says that when an agency makes one of these decisions, where they're called regulations about, you know, how things should operate, courts should typically stay out of that. They should defer to the agency's expertise. And the reason for that is very simple. Like, the environmental scientists at EPA probably know a lot about nitrogen and wastewater plants. And I mean, I went to law school. You put a black robe on me, it's not going to make me know anything about that. And, you know, so you want the people to know what they're talking about to make the decisions.
Right.
And the court is now threatening to overrule the Chevron decision, which would mean that many of these really important and really technical decisions are going to wind up, you know, the last word will be the judiciary and not people who are actually experts in the subject matter.
And what does that mean for us? I mean, you know, because right now there's this anti-knowledge movement going on to this country, this hatred of smart people. And coming out of the pandemic, you know, the CDC, you brought them up, and you know, now I know I've got listeners whose heads are exploding, going, they don't know anything. You know, what would be different then in this post world?
Yeah, well, so think about, like, I mean, let's just take some workplace issues. Like you may remember at the end of the Obama administration, Obama tried to expand the universe of people who could get overtime pay. I think it was up to like
47,500 some bucks. Yep.
Yeah. And like, you know, that wound up not happening because Trump came into office. But like, that was an agency regulation that would have led to a whole lot of people getting time and a half pay who weren't getting it before. I mean, think of what an agency like OSHA does. I mean, and think of like the granularity that like goes into workplace safety decisions. Like, you know, let's say you have a job where you have to wear safety goggles, and it turns out that like the plastic that's used in a particular brand of safety goggles just isn't safe. It doesn't protect people enough. OSHA is the agency that will issue a regulation saying, don't use that plastic, use this other plastic so people will be safe in their jobs. And we want, again, the experts at OSHA to make that decision and not to have it be the subject of years and years of litigation where, you know, your boss could potentially file a lawsuit that prevents you from getting the right goggles. And then there's an accident, you can lose an eye. So like this impacts, the Code of Federal Regulations is 200 volumes long. This impacts all kinds of things. So, you know, I can't even begin to list it. But basically, like every small decision that government has to make along the way is made by these federal agencies. And like any one of those decisions may not be the biggest deal in the world. But when you add them all up, you're talking about a lot of people's livelihoods. And in some cases, a lot of people's lives are at stake.
Yeah, but we're in this moment, Ian, and I'm sure you're noticing it like I am. If you got a red hat on, you know, regulations, you know, you start foaming at the mouth when you hear the dreaded R word. And, you know, you've heard, you know, Trump talk about, you know, what he's going to do if he comes back in. He's going to slash and gut and destroy the federal government. This plays into MAGA world. This is their mantra right now. This is something that I would look at this court being built for. This is the reason the Federalist Society and Leonard Leo spent so much money to get these people on this court for this in particular.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the issue is that companies exist to make profit and they make decisions that will help them make more money. They make decisions about the safety of their workers that will help them make more money. They make decisions about pay that will help, you know, they make decisions about how many toxic chemicals they will emit into the air that will help them make more money. And if you like every decision being made on the basis of whether your boss is going to make more money or whether everyone's boss is going to make more money, then by all means, you don't want any kind of regulation.
No, that's an excellent point. No, it really is an excellent point. I mean, because immediately you're talking about this, I'm thinking about Ford and the tires of a number of years ago, where they were literally deciding, you know, how much is your life worth? How much is it going to cost us in lawsuits to recall to put new tires on? And they were willing to let people die because the numbers added up in their favor.
Right. And often these are cases where, you know, the regulation asks someone to take, you know, asks the company to take on a very minor expense, you know, whether it's, you know, you have to provide safety goggles to certain workers or you have to provide like protective clothing to certain workers. You know, often these are things that, you know, cost the company nothing. But for the individual who benefits from that regulation, it can be the difference between being alive and not being alive, or the difference between being blind and not being blind.
Yeah, but this is one of those things where this is where I'm looking at the moment we're in, Ian, and you've got these people who, you know, we don't want regulation. We don't want smart people. We don't want to be told what we're to do. And I think about the seatbelt thing. I know people who, you know, wearing a seatbelt on a forklift drives them insane. How stupid is this that OSHA is going to make us do this? And yet there have been people who have been killed by not having them on. So it's one of those things that, yeah, you may hate doing it, but, you know, in the event that something bad happens, you know, it is what it is, and it saves the company as well. So I'm in this weird spot right now with this.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, everyone, you know, no one likes being told what to do. Everyone loves their freedom. I love my freedom. I hate when my boss tells me what to do. I hate when the government tells me what to do. But at the same time, I love the fact that when I drive my car, I'm not driving a Ford Pinto, like, you know, that I know it's not going to blow up on me. You know, I love the fact that, you know, when I go to work, I'm in a union, that there are federal laws and there are federal regulations that ensures that my employer deals with my union in a fair way. You know, that they have to negotiate with my union over certain things. And all of that comes from the fact that we have laws and we have regulation.
So let me ask you, before I move on to the next topic I got to get from you, what are the chances of them doing like they did with Dobbs and go the whole way? Is there a shortened version of eroding this? Is there midpoints? How do you see this playing out? Because I had, you know, some people tell me it's done, it's over. They're gonna undo the whole thing like they did in Dobbs. And I've had some other people saying, no, it's just this Loper case about putting an inspector on a boat that they're going to do something narrowly there. In your opinion, where do you see this potentially going?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is I don't know. I think they are going to weaken Chevron at the very least, which means less power for the federal agencies, more power for the Republican-controlled federal judiciary. And, you know, I don't know if they're going to go whole hog and say it's all up to judges now. Judges will have the final word on whether every regulation can stand. They've already taken a significant bite out of Chevron. You know, you may remember West Virginia v. EPA, the big case involving greenhouse emissions from last term. And basically what they said in that case is that if a regulation is really, really important, they said it deals with matters of vast economic or political significance, then the courts are going to have the final word on whether that regulation can stand. So they've already said that for like the really big, important stuff, the Supreme Court has the final word on everything and not, say, the EPA. This case really deals with the smaller stuff. You know, again, things on the scale, like the actual issue in the Loper case, the case that they're hearing, is there are federal observers who have to be on fishing boats to make sure that the boats aren't like overfishing and that the fisheries are sustainable and, you know, and all those reasons. And the question is how much of those fisheries have or those observers have to be paid by the federal government? How much has to be paid by the boat owner or the fishing company? And I mean, that's not the most important question in the world. Like, you know, the world's not going to rise or fall based on whether or not the fishing company has to kick in a little money to pay for these observers. But again, you add up all of these small decisions, you know, like what safety goggles do you have to wear? What kind of emissions do certain plants have to have? You know, who gets overtime pay? What vaccines does your health insurer have to cover? Like all of these are things that are decided by federal agencies. And you start to suddenly, you know, in the aggregate, it has a tremendous impact on everyone's lives. If the court goes too far, I think that they are likely to, you know, again, shift some power to the judiciary. I don't know if they're going to shift all of it.
It'll be interesting to see. Again, you know, as we know, if there's something having to do with corporate power, this court is going to side with corporate power. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent over at Vox and clairvoyant author of the book, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. This was written back in 2015, right? Right, Ian?
Basically. Oh, I guess that was my 2021 book. It was 2015 when I wrote Injustices, which is my first, yeah, this Supreme Court is bad book. And, you know, I wish I'd been wrong. I've looked at the whole history of the Supreme Court, and it's grim. You know, it is Dred Scott, the pro-slavery decision. It is Plessy v. Ferguson, the segregation decision. It is Lochner v. New York, which made it basically impossible to have progressive labor legislation for the first third of the 20th century. It is, you know, the decisions attacking the right to unionize. It is the Japanese internment decision. It is Bush v. Gore. The court has historically not served the American people well, and it is very much in the mode of not serving the American people well right now.
No, and this is where it brings me to the latest revelations, or at least people caring and paying attention to one of the Supreme Court justices seeming to be on the dole of a billionaire friend taking trips, yeah, and getting all kinds of goodies and things just because they're friends. Right. And as I said, you know, when this first broke, apparently I have the wrong friends. And because nobody's ever taken me on a $500,000 vacation or done any of the list of things that have gone on. So I'm curious your thoughts on this, because this really does put a stain on the court.
It does. And I mean, I don't know. Well, I have lots of friends who work for the federal government. None of them are Supreme Court justices. No, none of them wield anywhere near the amount of power that Clarence Thomas does. But I live in Washington, D.C. I have a lot of friends who are federal employees. And almost to a person, the level of ethical scrutiny that they get and like their own attention to ethical issues is extraordinary. You know, I'm a journalist. I'll sometimes take White House officials out to coffee. They will never let me pay for their coffee. Because, you know, they're just concerned about the ethical issue. If I buy them a $3 latte, then, you know, they don't want it to be in the newspaper that a reporter bought them a $3 latte. They don't want that ethical headache. Well, Clarence Thomas took a $500,000 trip to Indonesia on Harlan Crow's dime. Like, Clarence Thomas got a $17,000 or $19,000 Bible that was previously owned by Frederick Douglass from Harlan Crow. I mean, just imagine any government official. Like, imagine if you found out, and it's important to understand who Harlan Crow is. This isn't just a billionaire. This is a very politically active billionaire, a major donor to the Republican Party, someone with many, many decades of using his wealth to try to influence federal policy. You know, and like, if a congressman took a $19,000 gift from someone like that, I mean, we would call it a bribe. Like, yeah. like we would know what that is. You know, now I'm not saying that there's any quid pro quo here. I mean, Thomas is pretty reactionary to begin with, so we'd probably do the same thing that he's doing anyway. But no one in the government, except apparently the Supreme Court justices, are allowed to accept these kind of gifts because, I mean, if I have to explain to you why high-ranking officials that wield power over millions of people can't accept gifts that are 5, 6, 7 figures, you know, in value, like, I mean, ethics just isn't the sort of field you should be in if you don't understand that.
No, it's just the look of impropriety. I mean, from the outside, I'm going, you know, I had a congressman friend one time told me nobody has ever bought my vote. No one ever paid me. He said, here, this is for your vote. No one's ever written him a check, but they wrote him checks, you know, all throughout the year for their campaign, and they got his ear for a couple of minutes. So never bought his vote, but bought his time a little bit. And this is the same thing to me. You've got these justices who are taking these trips and going to these galas and raising money from all these rich people, because I argue that the Federalist Society and all the people that push them through groom them from a very young age to move them and think and have them think this line of this ideology, that now it's just natural for them. You don't have to pay for them anymore. They've already been bought and paid for.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like, the line between corruption and ideology can be very thin. You know, what the Federalist Society provides to a lot of these right wing judges, you know, it's not just, I mean, sometimes, I mean, I cover the Federalist Conference, the Federalist Society's conference, there's an open bar, the food is very nice, like, the Federalist Society does give them some things, but like, most of what the Federalist Society gives these folks is a social group. You know, a group of people who think like you and have similar interests to you, who can be not just your professional contacts, but your friends. And often that winds up being, I think, as compromising as a bribe could be. If someone offers me $10,000, like, I would like to have $10,000, but I don't know that I like it so much I would endanger my job for it. But if someone tells me I could lose all of my friends unless I do something, like, you know, human nature being what it is, that's a pretty potent incentive to do what those friends want me to do.
Yeah, no, we're all in this. And look, this isn't new, though. You know, the thing with Thomas has been around for a while. I think I remember 60 Minutes doing a piece on you know, him getting some bust and, you know, all kinds of gifts that he was getting that I didn't ask at the time if he reported it or not, and it turns out he didn't. And, you know, in fact, you know, when Antonin Scalia passed, he was on a ranch owned by some rich guy. Hey, come on, spend vacation time with me. We're friends kind of things. It's just for we, the little people down here, it doesn't seem right.
No, it's not right. I mean, again, no one else in government. I mean, like, one thing about, I mean, Harlan Crow has been giving these gifts to Clarence Thomas for 25 years. And the reason I mentioned that it's been going on for 25 years is that Clarence Thomas has been on the court for about 32 years. And so, like, this is a friend who befriended Clarence Thomas when he was already a powerful person. You know, one thing, you know, I was just talking with a friend of mine who's a federal government lawyer, and she said that when she was hired, one of the first things they told her is, if you accept a gift, don't even think of trying to justify it unless you were friends with the person before you were hired by the government. You know, I mean, I understand, like, you know, on my 50th birthday, if a friend of mine wants to buy me a nice bottle of scotch, you know, like my former college roommate, someone I've known forever, like, I don't think anyone's going to think that's compromising. I mean, that's friendship.
Yeah, Ian, no one took you on a $500,000 vacation for your 50th.
Exactly. But like, if there is an advocate who is trying to influence the way I cover things as a journalist, who like I, you know, suddenly approached me after I got hired by Vox and like was very interested in giving me nice gifts. I mean, for one thing, I would hope Vox would fire me if that happened. But you know, but second of all, like, that, where is that allowed? I mean, it's not allowed in government. It's not allowed in business. I mean, like, if I was just a guy whose job was to like negotiate contracts for a company, and I found out that a contractor was giving, you know, and my bosses found out that a contractor was giving me a bunch of gifts, like, I imagine that would be the end of my career.
Yeah. So last question, is this going to matter? Does this go anywhere? I know there are people, we got to impeach Tom. That's never happening. Does this go anywhere? Does this mean anything?
I mean, it's not going to mean anything in the sense that, you know, you need 67 votes to remove Clarence Thomas by impeachment. That means you need 16 Republicans to vote to remove him. That ain't happening.
No.
But, I mean, Clarence Thomas is a Republican appointee. I think people are beginning, you know, voters are beginning more and more to understand that partisan control of the Supreme Court matters. And so the question is, you know, I mean, if like the Republican nominee for president or if a Republican senator were taking these sorts of gifts from a politically connected billionaire, that would be a scandal. And I think the voters would punish the Republican Party at the polls. The question is whether the Republican Party is going to be punished at the polls for what Clarence Thomas is doing, because voters understand this is no different than if any other high-ranking Republican official were doing the exact same thing.
It's going to be interesting to see where this goes, but again, it doesn't look good. Ian, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. As always, great stuff.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Ian Millhiser. Make sure you check out the work he does over at Vox, Vox.com, the website. Also his book, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. I would change it, how they've already reshaped it. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at TheRickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. This is probably my favorite story of the day. Honestly, a good place to wrap up today with. Evidently, I've been looking at these Donald Trump ads, and he's running these ads all over the place saying, you know, Biden's, you know, horrible for America, the country's burning, you know, and you know just how bad things are, and it's all Biden's fault, and you know what they do. And interestingly enough, the B-roll, the background footage, the things that are burning, the bad stuff. Wanna fancy a guess when those images were taken? yeah, they were taken while he was president. And this is one of those weird things where you go, project much? Saying, look, the country's in a horrible place and, you know, it's horrible under Biden. But, oh, look how wonderful it was when I was president. It very, very twisted and just goes to that next step of they'll believe anything. If you've got the red hat on, gonna believe anything. It's like when they send these images around and, you know, with the memes and you go, but they don't marry up. And this is why, you know, in the brave new world, as I tell my kids, the number one skill you need to hone is filtering information, filtering sources, figuring out what to believe and what's BS. Because as AI continues to expand and as it takes over, and we start seeing these deep fakes and the kind of really, wow, us being able to evaluate it, that's going to be the important skill. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, you will find ours. Appreciate you tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC.